If this rainbow was a problem, would it be possible to strike at it directly? To destroy it at best, or at worst, distract it. Force it to focus in another direction.
I have to think that one through first, Dmitri, he said finally.
Popov nodded soberly, wondering what thoughts had gone through his employer's mind in the 15 seconds he'd taken to consider the question. Now it was his turn to be concerned. He'd just informed John Breitling of the operational dangers involved in using him, Popov, to set up the terrorist incidents, and especially of the flaws in his communications security. The latter especially had frightened the man. Perhaps he ought to have warned him earlier, but somehow the subject had never arisen, and Dmitri Arkadyevich now realized that it had been a serious error on his part. Well, perhaps not that great an error. Operational security was not all that bad. Only 2 people knew what was happening. Well, probably that Henriksen fellow as well. But Bill Henriksen was former FBI. And if he were an informer, then they'd all be in jail now. The FBI would have all the evidence it needed for a major felony investigation and trial, and would not allow things to proceed any further unless there were some vast criminal conspiracy yet to be uncovered. But how much larger would it have to be than conspiracy to commit murder? Moreover, they would have to know what the conspiracy was, else they would have no reason to hold off on their arrests. No, security here was good. And though the American government had the technical ability to decode Breitling's supposedly secure phone lines, even to tap them required a court order, and evidence was needed for that, and that evidence would itself be sufficient to put several people in death row cages. Including me, Popov reminded himself. What was going on here, the Russian demanded. He'd just thought it through enough to realize something. Whatever his employer was doing, it was larger than mass murder. What the hell could that be? Most worrisome of all, Popov had undertaken the missions in the hope—a realized hope, to be sure—of making a good deal of money off the job. He now had over $1 million in his Bern bank account, enough for him to return to Mother Russia and live very well indeed, but not enough for what he really wanted. So strange to discover that $1 million—that magic word to describe a magic number—was something that, once you had it, wasn't magical at all. It was just a number from which you had to subtract to buy the things you wanted. $1 million wasn't enough to buy the home he wanted, the car he wanted, the food he wanted, and then have enough left over to sustain the lifestyle he craved for the remainder of his life. Except, probably in Russia, where he did not unfortunately wish to live. To visit, yes. To stay, no. And so Dmitri was trapped, too. Trapped into what, he didn't know. And so here he was, sitting across the desk from someone who, like himself, was also busily trying to think things through. But neither of them knew where to go just yet. One of them knew what was happening, and the other did not. But the other one knew how to make things happen. And his employer did not. It was an interesting and somewhat elegant impasse. And so they just sat there for a minute or so, each regarding the other, and if not knowing what to say, then unwilling to take the risk of saying what they needed to. Finally, Breitling broke the silence.
I really need to think this situation through. Give me a day or so to do that?
Certainly. Popov stood, shook hands, and walked out of the office. A player for most of his adult life in that most interesting and fascinating of games, he realized now that he was in a new game, with new parameters. He'd taken possession of a vast sum of money, but an amount that his employer had regarded as trivial. He was involved in an operation whose import was larger than that of mass murder. That was not entirely new to him, Popov realized on reflection.
He'd once served a nation called by its ultimately victorious enemy, the evil empire. And that Cold War had been greater in size than mass murder. But Breitling was not a nation-state. And however huge his resources might be, they were minuscule in comparison with those of any advanced country. The great question remained. What the hell was this man trying to achieve? And why did he need the services of Dmitri Arkadyevich Popov to achieve it? Henriksen caught the Qantas flight for Los Angeles. He had the better part of a day ahead of him, in his first-class seat, a good deal of time to consider what he knew. The plan for the Olympics was essentially in the bag. The fogging system was in place, which was just plain perfect for the project's purposes. He'd have one of his men check out the system, and thereby get himself in place for the delivery part on the last day. It was that simple. He had the consulting contract needed to make it all happen. But now this Rainbow Bunch would be down there as well. How intrusive might they be? Damn, there was just no telling on that one. Worst case, it was possible that something small could toss a wrench into the works. It so often happened that way. He knew that from his time in the FBI. A random police patrol, a man on foot or in a radio car, could wander by and cause a well-planned robbery to stop. Or, in the investigation phase, the unexpectedly sharp memory of a random passerby, or a casual remark made by a subject to a friend, could come to the right investigator and blow a case wide open. Boom. That simple. It had happened a million times. And the brakes always went to the other side, didn't they? And so, from his perspective, he knew he had to eliminate the chance for such random events. He'd been so close to it. The operational concept had been brilliant. It had mainly been his from the beginning. John Breitling had merely funded it. Getting the terrorists to operate in Europe had raised the international consciousness about the threat, and that had allowed him and his company to get the contract to oversee the security for the Olympics. But then this damned Rainbow Team had appeared and handled three major incidents. And what asshole had instigated the third one, he demanded of himself? So well, that now the Australians had asked them to come down for a look. And if they came down, they'd stay and keep looking. And if that happened, they might be here for the games. And if they wondered about chemical weapons, then they might spot the perfect delivery system for them and... A lot of ifs, Henriksen told himself. A lot of ifs. A lot of things had to go wrong for the project to be thwarted. There was comfort in that thought. Maybe he could meet with the Rainbow people and direct them away from the threat. After all, he had a chemical weapons expert on the payroll, and they probably did not, and that gave him the edge, didn't it? With a little cleverness, his man could do his job right in front of them and not even be seen to have done it. That's what planning was for, wasn't it? Relax, he told himself, as the stewardess came around with drinks. And he had another glass of wine. Relax. But no, he couldn't do that. He had too much experience as an investigator to accept the mere chance of random interference without consideration of the possible consequences. If his man were stopped, even by accident, then it was also possible that the entire project could be uncovered. And that would mean more than failure. It would mean lifelong imprisonment at best, which was not something he was prepared to accept. No, he was committed to the project for more than one reason. It was his task to save the world, first of all. And second, he wanted to be around to enjoy what he'd had a hand in saving. And so, risks of any type and any magnitude were unacceptable. He had to come up with a way to eliminate them. The key to that was the Russian Popov. He wondered what that spook had discovered on his trip to England. With the right information, he could devise a plan to deal with that Rainbow Bunch directly, Wouldn't that be interesting? He settled back into his seat and chose a movie to semi-watch, to disguise what he was doing. Yes, he decided 10 minutes later, with the right people and the right assets, it could work. Popoff was eating dinner alone in a disreputable-looking restaurant at the southern end of Manhattan. The food was reportedly good, but the place looked as though rats cleaned up the floor at night. But the vodka here was superb, and as usual, a few drinks helped him think abstractly. What did he know about John Breitling? Well, the man was a scientific genius, and also very impressive in his business skills. He'd been married some years ago to another bright person, now the presidential science advisor. But the marriage had ended badly, and now his employer flitted from bed to bed, one of the most eligible bachelors in America, and with the financial statement to prove it, with his photo frequently in the society pages, which must have been the cause of some discomfort to his former wife. He had good connections in the community of people admitted into classified matters. This Rainbow Group was evidently black, but he'd gotten its name and the name of its commander in a day. Just one day, Popoff reminded himself. That was beyond impressive. It was startling. How the hell had he accomplished that? And he was into an operation whose implications were more serious than mass murder. That was where his mind came to a befuddled halt once again. It was like walking down a busy street, and then coming up against a blank wall. What could a businessman be doing that was more serious than that? More serious than the risk of losing his freedom? Even the death penalty? If it were greater than mass murder, then did the plan contemplate even larger murder? But to serve what end? To start a war, perhaps? But he was not a chief of state, and could not therefore start a war. Was Breitling a spy, feeding vital national security class information to a foreign government? But in return for what? How could anyone, government or not, bribe a billionaire? No, money was out. What did that leave? There was a classic acronym for the reasons for making treason against your native land. MICE. Money, ideology, conscience, and ego. Money was out. Breitling had too much of that. Ideology was always the best motivation for a traitor, spy. People would risk their lives far more readily for their closely held beliefs than for filthy lucre. But what ideology did this man have? Popoff didn't know. Next came conscience. But conscience against what? What wrong was he trying to right? There could hardly be one, could there? That left ego. Well, Breitling had a capacious ego, but ego assumed the motive of revenge against some more powerful person or institution that had wronged him. Who could possibly have hurt billionaire John Breitling? So much that his material success was not a sufficient salve against the wound. Popoff waved to the waiter for another vodka. He'd be taking a cab home tonight. No, money was out. So was ego. That left ideology and conscience. What beliefs or what wrong could motivate a man to do murder on a large scale? In the former case, Breitling was not a religious fanatic. In the latter, he had no overt dissatisfaction with his country. And so, while money and ego could readily be dismissed, ideology and conscience were almost as unlikely, and Popoff did not dismiss them only because... Why? He asked himself. Because he only had four possible motivations. Unless Breitling was a total madman. And he wasn't that, was he? No, Popoff told himself. His employer was not mentally unbalanced. He was thoughtful in his every action. And though his perspective, especially on the issue of money, was very different from his own, well, he had so much that such a difference in outlook was understandable. It was just a matter of perspective, and to him $1 million was like pocket change to Dmitri Arkadyevitch. Could he then be some sort of madman who, like a chief of state, a new Saddam Hussein or Adolf Hitler, or Joseph Vissarionovich Stalin? But no, he was not a chief of state, had no aspirations for such a thing, and only those men could entertain that form of madness. In his career in the KGB, Popov had dealt with all manner of curiosities. He'd played the game against world-class adversaries and never once been caught, never once failed in an assignment. As a result, he considered himself a clever sort. That made the current impasse all the more frustrating. He had over $1 million in a Bern bank. He had the prospect of more in due course. He'd set up 2 terrorist missions that had accomplished their goal. Had they? His employer evidently thought so, despite the abject tactical failure of both. But he knew even less now, Dmitri Arkadyevitch told himself. The more he delved into it, the less he knew. And the less he knew, the unhappier he became. He'd asked his employer more than once the reason for his activities, but Breitling wasn't telling. It had to be something vast, but what the devil was it? They practiced the breathing exercises. Ding found it amusing, but he was also persuaded that it was necessary. Tall and rangy though Patsy was, she was not the athlete he'd become to lead Team 2, and so she had to practice how to breathe to make the baby come more easily. And practice did make perfect. And so they sat on the floor of their house, both with their legs spread, huffing and puffing, as though to destroy the home of a mythical pig. And it was all he could do not to laugh. "Deep, cleansing breath," Domingo said, after timing the notional contraction. Then he reached for her hand and bent forward to kiss it. "How we doing, Pats?"
"I'm ready, Ding. I just want it to happen and be over."
"Worried?"
"Well," Patsy Clark Chavez, M.D., replied, "I know it's going to hurt some, and I'd just as soon have it behind me, you know?"
"Yeah," Ding nodded. The anticipation of unpleasant things was usually worse than their realization, at least on the physical side. He knew that from experience. But she didn't yet. Maybe that was why second deliveries were almost always easier than the first. You knew what to expect. Knew that though it was uncomfortable, you'd make it through, and have a baby at the end of it. That was the key to the whole thing for Domingo. To be a father. To have a child, to begin the greatest of all adventures, raising a new life, doing the best you could, making some mistakes, but learning from all of them, and ultimately presenting to society a new, responsible citizen to carry on. That, he was sure, was what it meant to be a man. Oh, sure, carrying a gun and doing his job was important, too, since he was now a guardian of society, a righter of wrongs, a protector of the innocent, one of the forces of order from which came civilization itself. But this was his chance to be personally involved in what civilization really was, the raising of kids in the right way, educating and guiding them to do the right thing, even at 3 in the morning and half asleep. Maybe the kid would be a spook soldier like him, or maybe even better, a physician like Pat's. An important and good part of society, serving others. Those things could only happen if he and Pats did the job right, and that responsibility was the greatest that any person could undertake. Domingo looked forward to it, lusted to hold his child in his arms, to kiss and cuddle, to change diapers and clean bottoms. He'd already assembled the crib, decorated the walls of the nursery with pink and blue bunnies, and bought toys to distract the little beast. And though all of these things seemed incongruous with his regular life, both he and the men of Rainbow knew different, for all of them had children as well, and for them the covenant was exactly the same. Eddie Price had a boy of 14 years, somewhat rebellious and decidedly headstrong,
probably just as his father had once been, but also bright enough to question everything to seek his own answers, which he would find in due course, just as his father had done. The kid had soldier written all over him, Ding thought. But with luck, he'd go to school first and become an officer, as Price should have done, and would have done in America. Here the system was different, though, and so he'd become a superb command sergeant major, Ding's most trusted subordinate, always ready to offer his thoughts, and then execute his orders perfectly. Yes, there was much to look forward to, Ding told himself, still holding Patsy's hand in his own.
Scared?
Not scared. A little nervous, Patsy admitted. Honey, if it were all that hard, how come there's so many people in the world?
Spoken like a man, Dr. Patricia Chavez noted. It's easy for you to say. You don't have to do it.
I'll be there to help, her husband promised.
You better be.
Chapter 23 Overwatch Henriksen arrived at JFK International with his body feeling as though it had been shredded, spindled, and mutilated before being tossed into a waste paper basket. But that was to be expected. He'd flown, literally, halfway around the globe in about a day, and his internal body clock was confused and angry and punishing. For the next week or so, he'd find himself awake and asleep at random times, but that was all right. The right pills and a few drinks would help him rest when rest was needed. An employee was waiting for him at the end of the jetway, took his carry-on without a word, and led off to the baggage claim area, where, blessedly, his two-seater was the fifth bag on the carousel, which allowed them to scoot out of the terminal and onto the highway to New York City.
"How was the trip?"
"We got the contract," Henriksen told his man, who was not part of the project.
"Good," the man said, not knowing how good it was, and how bad it would be for himself.
Henriksen buckled his seatbelt and leaned back to catch a few winks on the way in, ending further conversation.
"So, what do we got?" the FBI agent asked.
"Nothing so far," D'Alessandro replied. "I have one other possible missing girl, same area for her apartment, similar looks, age, and so forth. Disappeared around the same time as your Miss Bannister. Name is Ann Pretlow, legal secretary, just vanished off the face of the earth."
"Jane Doe's?" the other federal officer asked.
"Nothing that matches. Guys, we have to face the possibility that we have a serial killer loose in the area."
"But why did this email message come out?"
"How does it match with other emails Miss Bannister sent to her dad?" the NYPD detective asked.
"Not very well," the senior FBI agent admitted.
"The one he initially brought into the Gary office looks as though, well, it smells to me like drugs, you know."
"Agreed," D'Alessandro said. "You have others?"
"Here." The agent handed over six printouts faxed to the New York office. The detective scanned them. They were all perfectly grammatical and organized, with no misspellings on any of them.
"What if she didn't send it? What if somebody else did?"
"The serial killer?" the junior FBI agent asked. Then he thought about it, and his face mirrored what he thought.
"He'd have to be a real sick one, Mario."
"Yeah, well, serial killers aren't Eagle Scouts, are they?"
"Tormenting the families? Have we ever had one like that?" the senior man wondered.
"Not that I know of, Tom, but like the man said."
"Shit," observed the senior agent, Tom Sullivan.
"Call behavioral sciences in on this one?" the junior agent, Frank Chatham, asked.
Sullivan nodded.
"Yeah, let's do that.
I'll call Pat O'Connor about it. Next step here, I think we get some flyers printed up with the photo of Mary Bannister and start passing them out on the west side. Mario, can you get us some cooperation from your people?"
"No problem," D'Alessandro replied. "If this is what it looks like, I want the fuck before he starts going for some sort of record. Not in my town, guys.
the detective concluded.
"Going to try the interleukin again?" Barbara Archer asked.
"Yeah," Kilgore nodded. 3A is supposed to enhance the immune system, but they're not sure how. I'm not either. But if it has any effect, we need to know about it.
What about lung complications?
One of the problems with interleukin was that it attacked lung tissue, also for unknown reasons, and could be dangerous to smokers and others with respiratory problems.
Another nod.
Yeah, I know, just like 2, but F4 isn't a smoker. And I want to make sure that 3A doesn't do anything to compromise Shiva. We can't take that chance, Barb.
Agreed, Dr. Archer observed.
Like Kilgore, she didn't think that this new version of interleukin was the least bit helpful, but that had to be confirmed.
What about interferon?
The French have been trying that on hemorrhagic fever for the last 5 years, but no results at all. We can hang that, too, but it's going to be a dry hole, Barb.
Let's try it on F4 anyway, she suggested.
Fair enough.
Kilgore made a notation on the chart and left the room. A minute later, he appeared on the TV monitor.
"Hi, Mary. How are we feeling this morning? Any better?"
"No."
She shook her head. "Stomach still hurts pretty bad."
"Oh, really?
Let's see what we can do about that." This case was proceeding rapidly. Kilgore wondered if she had a genetic abnormality in her upper GI, maybe some vulnerability to peptic ulcer disease. If so, then the Shiva was going to rip her apart in a hurry. He increased the morphine dosage rate on the machine next to her bed.
"Okay, now we're going to give you a couple of new medications. These ought to fix you up in 2 or 3 days, okay?"
"Are these the ones I signed up for?"
F4 asked weakly.
"Yes, that's right," Kilgore replied, hanging the interferon and interleukin 3A on the medication tree.
"These ought to make you feel a lot better," he promised with a smile.
It was so odd, talking to his lab rats. While, as he told himself many times, a rat was a pig, was a dog, was a girl, in this case, there wasn't really all that much of a difference, was there?
"No," he told himself this afternoon.
Her body relaxed with the increased morphine dose, and her eyes became unfocused. Well, that was one difference, wasn't it? They didn't give rats sedatives or narcotics to ease their pain. It wasn't that they didn't want to, just that there was no practical way to ease their discomfort. It had never pleased him to see those cute pink eyes change from bright to dull, reflecting the pain. Well, in this case at least, the dullness mirrored a respite from the pain.
The information was very interesting, Henriksen thought, and this Russian was pretty good at developing it. He would have made a good agent for the Foreign Counterintelligence Division. But then that's just what he had been, in a way, only working for the other side, of course. And with the information, he recalled his idea from the Qantas flight.
"Dmitri," Bill asked, "do you have contacts in Ireland?"
Popov nodded.
"Yes, several of them."
Henriksen looked over at Dr. Breitling for approval and got a nod.
"How would they like to get even with the SAS?
"That has been discussed many times, but it is not practical. It is like sending a bank robber into a guarded bank.
No, that is not right. It is like sending a robber into the government agency which prints the money. There are too many defensive assets to make the mission practical."
"But they actually wouldn't be going to Hereford, would they? What if we could draw them out into the open, and then stage our own little surprise for them?"
Henriksen explained on.
It was a very interesting idea, Popov thought. But
it is still a very dangerous mission.
"Very well.
What is the current condition of the IRA?
Popov leaned back in his chair.
"They are badly split. There are now several factions. Some want peace. Some want the disorders to continue.
The reasons are both ideological and personal to the faction members. Ideological insofar as they truly believe in their political objective of overturning both the British rule in Northern Ireland and the Republican government in Dublin, and establishing a progressive socialist government. As an objective, it's far too ambitious for a practical world, yet they believe in it and hold to it. They are committed Marxists. Actually more Maoist than Marxist, but that is not important to us at the moment.
And the personal side? Breitling asked.
When one is a revolutionary, it is not merely a matter of belief, but also a matter of perception by the public. To many people, a revolutionary is a romantic character, a person who believes in a vision of the future and is willing to risk his life for it. From that comes his social status. Those who know such people often respect them. Therefore, to lose that status injures the former revolutionary. He must now work for a living, drive a truck or whatever he is capable of.
Like what happened to you when the KGB riffed you, in other words, Henriksen offered.
Popoff had to nod at that.
In a way, yes. As a field officer of state security, I had status and importance enjoyed by few others in the Soviet Union, and losing that was more significant to me than the loss of my modest salary. It will be the same for these Irish Marxists. And so they have two reasons for wanting the disorders to continue. Their political, ideological beliefs, and their need for personal recognition as something more than ordinary worker citizens.
Do you know such people? Henriksen asked pointedly.
Yes, I can probably identify some.
I met many in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, where they trained with other progressive elements. And I have traveled to Ireland on occasion to deliver messages and money to support their activities. Those operations tied up large segments of the British Army, you see, and were therefore worthy of Soviet support as a distraction to a large NATO enemy.
Popoff ended his discourse, looking at the other two men in the room.
What would you have them do?
It's not so much of a question of what as of how, Bill told the Russian. You know, when I was in the Bureau, we used to say that the IRA was composed of the best terrorists in the world, dedicated, smart, and utterly vicious.
I would agree with that assessment. They were superbly organized, ideologically sound, and willing to undertake nearly anything if it had a real political impact.
How would they view this mission?
What mission is that? Dmitri asked.
And then Bill explained his basic mission concept. The Russian listened politely and thoughtfully before responding.
That would appeal to them, but the scope and the dangers are very large.
What would they require to cooperate?
Money and other support, weapons, explosives, the things they need to carry on their operations. The current faction fighting has probably had the effect of disrupting their logistical organization.
That's doubtless how the peace faction is trying to control the continued violence faction, simply by restricting their access to weapons. Without that, they cannot take physical action, and cannot, therefore, enhance their own prestige. So, if you offer them the wherewithal to conduct operations, they will listen seriously to your plan.
Money?
Money allows one to purchase things. The factions with which we would deal have probably been cut off from regular funding sources.
Which are? Breitling asked.
Drinking clubs. And what you call the protection racket, yes?
That's right, Henriksen confirmed with a nod. That's how they get their money, and that source is probably well controlled by the peace factions.
So then, how much do you think, Dmitri? John Breitling asked.
Several million dollars, I should say. At the least, that is.
You have to be very careful laundering it, Bill warned their boss. I can help.
Call it 5 million?
That should be enough, Popoff said, after a moment's reflection.
plus the psychological attraction of bearding the lion so close to his own den. But I can offer no promises. These people make their own decisions, for their own reasons.
How quickly can you arrange the meeting?
2 days, perhaps three, after I arrive in Ireland, Popoff answered.
Get your tickets, Breitling told him decisively.
One of them did some talking before he deployed, Tawny said. His name was René. Before he set off to Spain, he chatted with a girlfriend. She had an attack of conscience and came in on her own. The French interviewed her yesterday.
And? Clark asked.
And the purpose of the mission was to free Carlos. But he said nothing to her about their being assigned the mission by anyone. In fact, he said little, though the interview did develop the name of another participant in the mission, or so our French colleagues think. They're running that name down now. The woman in question, well, he and she had been friends, lovers, for some time, and evidently he confided in her. She came to the police on her own because of the dead Dutch child. The Paris papers have made a big show of that, and it's evidently troubled her conscience. She told the police that she tried to talk him out of the job. Not sure that I believe that. And that he told her that he'd think about it. Evidently he didn't follow through on that, but the French are now wondering if someone might have opted out. They're sweeping up the usual suspects for a chat. Perhaps they'll turn up something, Tawny concluded hopefully.
That's all? Clark asked.
It's quite a lot, really, Peter Covington observed. It's rather more than we had yesterday, and it allows our French friends to pursue additional leads.
Maybe, Chavez allowed, but why did they go out? Who's turning these bastards loose?
Anything from the other two incidents? Clark asked.
Not a bloody peep, Tawny replied. The Germans have rattled every bush. Cars were seen going in and out of the Firkner Dortmund house. But she was an artist, and they might well have been buyers of her paintings. In any case, no vehicle descriptions, much less license plate numbers. That is dead, unless someone else walks into a police station and makes a statement.
Known associates? Covington asked.
All interviewed by the BKA with no results. Hans and Petra were never known for talking. The same was true of Model and Guttenach. Tawny waved his hands in frustration.
"'It's out there, John,' Chavez said. "'I can feel it.'
"'I agree,' Covington said with a nod, "'but the trick's getting our hands on it.'
Clark frowned mightily. But he knew the drill, too, from his time in the field. You wanted information to develop, but merely wanting it never made it happen. Things like that just came to you when they decided to come. It was that simple. And that maddening. Especially when you knew it was there— and you knew that you needed it. With one small bit of information, Rainbow could turn some national police force loose and sweep up the person or persons they wanted and grill them over a slow fire until they got what they needed. The French or the Germans would be best. Neither of them had the legal restrictions that the Americans and Brits had placed on their police forces. But that wasn't a good way to think. And the FBI usually got people to spill their guts, even though they treated all criminals with white kid gloves. Even terrorists, once caught, usually told what they knew. Well, not the Irish, John remembered. Some of those bastards wouldn't say boo, not even their own names. Well, there were ways of handling that level of recalcitrance. It was just a matter of speaking to them outside of police view, putting the fear of God and of pain into them. That usually worked, had always worked in John Clark's experience. But first you needed somebody to talk to. That was the hard part. As a field officer of the CIA, he'd often enough been in distant, uncomfortable places on a mission, then had the mission aborted, or, just as bad, postponed, because some vital bit of information had been missing or lost. He'd seen 3 men and 1 woman die for that reason, in 4 different places, all of them behind the Iron Curtain. 4 people, all of whose faces he'd known, lost,
judicially murdered by their parent countries. Their struggle against tyranny had ultimately been successful, but they hadn't lived to see it or enjoy the fruits of their courage. And it was part of Clark's conscience that he remembered every single one of them. And because of that, he'd grown to hate the people who'd had the information he'd needed, but had not been able to get out in time. So it was now. Ding was right. Somebody was calling these animals out of their lairs, and he wanted that somebody. Finding him or her would give them all manner of names and telephone numbers and addresses for the European police agencies to sweep up into one big bag, and so end much of the terrorism that still hung over Europe like a cloud. And that would be a hell of a lot better than sending his troopers out into the field with loaded guns. Popoff packed his bags. He was getting quite expert at this, the Russian told himself, and had learned to pack his shirts without their coming out of the bag wrinkled, which he'd never learned as a KGB officer. Well, the shirts were more expensive now, and he'd learned to take better care of them. The suitcases, however, reflected his previous occupation, and included some special pockets and compartments in which he could keep his alternate travel documents. These he kept with him at all times now. Should the whole project collapse of its own weight, he wanted to be able to disappear without a trace, and his three unused sets of documents should help in that. In the final extreme, he could access his burned bank account and disappear back into Russia, though he had other plans for his future. But he worried that greed might be clouding his judgment. $5 million. If he could bank that to himself, then he'd have the resources he needed to live in comfort forever, in virtually any place of his choosing, especially if he invested it wisely. But how could he defraud the IRA out of the money detailed to them? Well, that might easily come to him. Then his eyes closed, and he asked himself about greed. Was it indeed clouding his operational judgment? Was he taking an unnecessary chance, led along by his wish to have this huge amount of money? It was hard to be objective about one's own motivations. And it was hard to be a free man now, not just one of thousands of field officers in the Committee for State Security, having to justify every single dollar, pound, or ruble he spent to the accountants at No. 2 Dzerzhinsky Square, the most humorless people in a singularly humorless agency. Greed, Popoff thought, worrying about it. He had to set that whole issue aside. He had to go forward as the professional he'd always been, careful and circumspect at every turn, lest he be caught by enemy counterintelligence services, or even by the people with whom he would be meeting. The provisional wing of the Irish Republican Army was as ruthless as any terrorist organization in the world, though its members could be jolly fellows over a drink. In their drinking they so closely resembled Russians. They killed their enemies, inside and outside their organization, with as little compunction as medical testers with their laboratory rats. Yet they could also be loyal to a fault. In that, they were predictable. And that was good for Popoff. And he knew how to deal with them. He'd done so often enough in the past, both in Ireland and the Bekaa Valley. He just couldn't let them discern his desire to bank the money earmarked to them, could he? The packing done, Popoff took his bags to the elevator, then down to the street level, where the apartment house's doorman flagged him a cab for LaGuardia, where he'd board the shuttle for Boston's Logan International, and there to catch the Aer Lingus flight to Dublin. If nothing else, his work for Breitling had gotten him a lot of frequent flyer miles, though with too many different airlines to be of real help. But they always flew him first class, which KGB had never done, Dmitri Arkadyevich thought with a suppressed smile in the back seat of the cab. All he had to do, he reminded himself, was deal honestly with the PIRA.
If the opportunity came to steal their money, then he'd take it. But he already knew one thing. They'd jump at the proposed operation. It was too good to pass up. And if nothing else, the PIRA had elan. Special Agent Patrick O'Connor looked over the information faxed from New York. The trouble with kidnapping investigations was time. No investigation ever ran quickly enough, but it was worse with kidnappings, because you knew that somewhere was a real person whose life depended upon your ability to get the information and act upon it before the kidnapper decided to end his nasty little game, kill the current hostage, and go grab another. Grab another? Yes, probably, because there had been no ransom demand. And that meant that whoever had snatched Mary Bannister off the street wasn't willing to sell her back. No, he'd be using her as a toy, almost certainly for sexual gratification, until he tired of her. And then, probably, he'd kill her. And so, O'Connor thought himself to be in a race, albeit on a track he couldn't see, and running against a stopwatch hidden in the hand of another. He had a list of Miss Bannister's local friends and associates, and he had his men and women out talking to them, hoping to turn up a name or a phone number that would lead them on to the next step in the investigation. But probably not, he thought. No, this case was all happening in New York. This young woman had gone there to seek her fortune in the bright city lights, like so many others. And many of them did find what they were seeking, which was why they went. But this one, from the outskirts of Gary, Indiana, had gone there without knowing what it was like in a big city, and lacked the self-protective skills one needed in a city of 8 million. And she was probably already dead, O'Connor admitted quietly to himself, killed by whatever monster had snatched her off the street. There was not a damn thing he could do about it except to identify, arrest, and convict the creep, which would save others, but wouldn't be worth a damn to the victim whose name titled the case file on his desk. Well, that was one of the problems of being a cop. You couldn't save them all. But you did try to avenge them all, and that was something, the agent told himself, as he rose to get his coat for the drive home. Chavez sipped his Guinness and looked around the club. The Eagle of the Legion had been hung on the wall opposite the bar, and people already went over to touch the wooden staff in respect. Three of his team two people were at a table, drinking their brews and chatting about something or other with two of Peter Covington's troops. The TV was on. Snooker championships? Chavez wondered. That was a national event? Which changed into news and weather. More El Niño stuff, Ding saw with a snort. Once it had just been called weather, but then some damned oceanographer had discovered that the warm, cold water mix off the coast of South America changed every few years, and that when it happened, the world's climate changed a little bit here and there, and the media had latched onto it, delighted, so it seemed, to have another label to put on things they lacked the education to understand. Now they said that the current rendition of the El Niño effect was unusually hot weather in Australia. Mr. C., you're old enough to remember. What did they say before this crap? They called it unusually hot, cold, or seasonable weather. Tried to tell you if it was going to be hot, cold, sunny, or rainy the next day. And then they told you about the baseball scores. With rather less accuracy on the weather side, Clark didn't say. How's Patsy doing? Another couple of weeks, John. She's holding up pretty well, but she bitches about how big her belly's gotten to be. He checked his watch. Ought to be home in another 30 minutes. Same shift with Sandy. Sleeping okay? John went on. Yeah, a little restless when the little hombre rolls around, but she's getting all she needs. Be cool, John. I'm taking good care of her. Looking forward to being a grandpa? Clark sipped at his third pint of the evening. One more milestone on the road to death, I suppose. Then he chuckled.
Yeah, Domingo, I am looking forward to it.
I'll spoil the shit out of this little bastard, and then just hand him back when he cries.
Ready to be a pop?
I think I can handle it, John. How hard can it be? You did it.
Clark ignored the implicit challenge.
We're going to be sending a team down to Australia in a few weeks.
What for? Chavez asked.
The Aussies are a little worried about the Olympics, and we look pretty sexy 'cause of all the missions we've had. So they want some of us to come on down and look over things with their SAS.
Their guys any good?
Clark nodded.
So I'm told. But never hurts to get an outside opinion, does it?
Who's going down?
I haven't decided yet. They already have a consulting company, Global Security Limited, run by a former FBI guy. Noonan knows him. Henriksen, something like that.
Have they ever had a terrorist incident down there? Domingo asked next.
Nothing major that I can remember, but, well, you don't remember Munich in 72, do you?
Chavez shook his head.
Just what I've read about it. The German cops really screwed the pooch on that mission.
Yeah, I guess. Nobody ever told them that they'd have to face people like that.
Well, now we all know, right?
That's how GSG-9 got started. And they're pretty good.
Like the Titanic, eh? Ships have enough lifeboats because she didn't?
John nodded agreement.
That's how it works.
It takes a hard lesson to make people learn, son.
John set his empty glass down.
Okay, but how come the bad guys never learn? Chavez asked, finishing off his second of the evening.
We've delivered some tough lessons, haven't we?
But you think we can fold up our tents?
Not hardly, Mr. C.
They're still out there, John. And they're not retiring, are they?
They ain't learned shit.
Well, I'd sure as hell learn from it.
Maybe they're just dumber than we are.
Ask Bellow about it, Clark suggested.
I think I will.
Popoff was fading off to sleep. The ocean below the Aer Lingus 747 was dark now, and his mind was well forward of the aircraft, trying to remember faces and voices from the past, wondering if perhaps his contact had turned informer to the British Security Service, and would doom him to identification and possible arrest.
Probably not. They'd seemed very dedicated to their cause.
But you could never be sure. People turned traitor for all manner of reasons. Popoff knew that well. He'd helped more than his share of people do just that, changing their loyalties, betraying their countries, often for small amounts of cash. How much the easier to turn against an atheist foreigner who'd given them equivocal support. What if his contacts had come to see the futility of their cause? Ireland would not turn into a Marxist country, for all their wishes. The list of such nations was very thin now, though across the world academics still clung to the words and ideas of Marx and Engels and even Lenin.
Fools.
There were even those who said that communism had been tried in the wrong country, that Russia had been far too backward to make those wonderful ideas work. That was enough to bring an ironic smile and a shake of the head. He'd once been part of the organization called the Sword and Shield of the Party. He'd been through the academy, had sat through all the political classes, learned the answers to the inevitable examination questions, and been clever enough to write down exactly what his instructors wanted to hear, thus ensuring high marks and the respect of his mentors, few of whom had believed in that drivel any more than he had, but none of whom had found within themselves the courage to speak their real thoughts. It was amazing how long the lies had lasted, and truly Popoff could remember his surprise when the red flag had been pulled down from its pole atop the Kremlin's Spasskaya Gate. Nothing, it seemed, lived longer than a perverse idea. Chapter 24 Customs. One of the differences between Europe and America was that the former's countries truly welcomed foreigners, while America, for all her hospitality, made entering the country remarkably inconvenient. Certainly the Irish erected no barriers, Popoff saw, as his passport was stamped, and he collected his luggage for an inspection so cursory that the inspector probably hadn't noticed if the person carrying it was male or female. With that, Dmitri Arkadyevich walked outside and flagged a cab for his hotel. His reservation gave him a one-bedroom suite overlooking a major thoroughfare, and he immediately undressed to catch a few more hours of sleep before making his first call. His last thought before closing his eyes on this sunny morning was that he hoped the contact number hadn't been changed or compromised. If the latter, then he'd have to do some explaining to the local police. But he had a cover story, if necessary. While it wasn't perfect, it would be good enough to protect a person who'd committed no crimes in the Republic of Ireland.
"Airborne, airborne, have you heard?" Vega sang, as they began the final mile. "We're gonna jump from the big-ass bird!"
It surprised Chavez that as bulky as First Sergeant Julio Vega was, he never seemed to suffer from it on the runs. He was a good 30 pounds heavier than any other Team 2 member. Any bigger across the chest, and he'd have to get his fatigue shirts custom-made. But despite the ample body, his legs and wind hadn't failed him yet. And so, today, he was taking his turn leading the morning run. In another 4 minutes, they could see the stop line, which they all welcomed, though none of them would admit it.
"Quick time! March!"
Vega called, as he crossed the yellow line, and everyone slowed to the usual 120 steps per minute.
"Left! Left! Your left! Your right! Your left!"
Another half minute, and
"Detail! Halt!"
And everyone stopped. There was a cough or two from those who'd had a pint or two too many the night before, but nothing more than that. Chavez walked to the command position in front of the two lines of troopers.
"Fall out!"
he ordered, allowing Team 2 to walk to their building for a shower, having stretched and exercised all their muscles for the day. Later today they'd have another run through the shooting house for a live-fire exercise. It would be boring in content, since they'd already tried just about every possible permutation of hostages and bad guys. Their shooting was just about perfect. Their physical condition was perfect, and their morale was so high that they seemed bored. They were so confident in their abilities, they'd demonstrated them so convincingly in the field, firing real bullets into real targets. Even his time with the 7th Light Infantry Division had not given him such confidence in his people. They'd gotten to the point that the British SAS troopers, who had a long, proud history of their own, and who'd initially looked upon the Rainbow Teams with a great degree of skepticism, now welcomed them into the club and even admitted they had things to learn from them. And that was quite a stretch, since the SAS had been the acknowledged world masters at special operations. A few minutes later, showered and dressed, Chavez came out to the squad bay, where his people were at their individual desks, going over intelligence information from Bill Tawney and his crew, and checking out photos, many of them massaged by the computer systems to allow for the years since they'd originally been taken. The systems seemed to get better on a daily basis as the software evolved. A picture taken from an angle was now manipulated by the computer into a straight-on portrait shot, and his men studied them as they might examine photos of their own children, along with whatever information they had of who was suspected to be where, with what known or suspected associates, and so forth. It seemed a waste of time to Chavez, but you couldn't run and shoot all day, and knowing the faces wasn't a total waste of time. They had identified Ferkner and Dortmund that way on their Vienna deployment, hadn't they? Sergeant Major Price was going over budget stuff,
which he'd toss onto Ding's desk for later examination, so that his boss could justify expenditures, and then maybe request some new training funds for some new